Hello and welcome to the Baby Giants Investing Podcast. Join us as we chat about the weird and wild world of small cap investing, all while searching for the precious few fast-growing businesses that have a shot at becoming industry giants.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for investment decisions. Podcast guests and their clients may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
All right, we're live. Let's get into it. We've got a bit of good news. I don't know if you guys have any good news. 1 month after experimental pig heart transplant, doctors say they see no signs of rejection or infection. So a man with end-stage heart disease has had the transplanted into him the heart of a genetically modified pig. 58-year-old Lawrence Forsett underwent the surgery, only the second ever performed in a human. So there you go. Could have pigs growing organs for us for longevity.
They're the animal that just keeps on giving, aren't they? Bacon and chops and now organs.
There you go. What do you think, Claude? Is there some horrible Frankenstein bad news that I'm not thinking about here?
It's like you want me to turn it into bad news.
We have a pattern. Any other good news from you guys?
Oh man, it's hard to find good news in this day and age. I'll say that much. It's don't open a newspaper. It's pretty bleak out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad news out there. All right. Well, yeah, let's chat some macro. So the breaking news as we're recording this on Wednesday is CPI numbers coming in pretty hot, I think. Andrew, you've been tracking this pretty closely. Did you have any thoughts on the latest CPI?
Nothing that isn't ridiculously cynical and depressing. I don't know. I don't know how many times forecasts have to be wrong and we have to be surprised by it, like even 3 months out kind of forecast. So there is that.
For those who don't follow it, I mean, what's the key news?
It was high. It was really high, higher than they expected. For some reason, like increasing the cost of borrowing doesn't have much of an impact on rents.
So one thing I noticed, right, just before you segue into property, just for the people that might not follow the numbers, right? So the actual CPI was 1.2% change from previous quarter. So mm-hmm. The CPI was up 1.2% this quarter. And from memory, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was above what the expectations were. And previously there'd been some sort of speech by the RBA or a comment from the RBA saying that if inflation was materially above expectations, then they would potentially, you know, do more rate rises, right? So Essentially now this CPI has come in. You could, I don't know. That's why I'm trying to check with you guys. But, you know, it's above expectations, right? So that's what the headlines is anyway. So does that, you know, mean that we're in for another rate rise?
That's what the punditry seems to be suggesting, the one that is consistently wrong on their expectations. So again, take that with a grain of salt. But it is, I mean, the RBA has very much, I was going to say, painted itself into a corner. That's not the best way of framing it. But I mean, they have very much pitched their flag on the hill of, we will not tolerate higher inflation and we'll do whatever it takes. And even on their own forecast, let alone what was consensus out there in the market, it was much stronger than they were expecting. We've had commentary around what's going on the Middle East and what that might mean for fuel prices and wider inflation. The bond market, for what predictive powers lay there, is pretty much saying that a rate rise by Melbourne Cup Day is, like, I think it's a 60% chance, and by the end of the year is a near certainty. So that seems to be the expectation. I just don't understand. One of the interesting things, while I just continually throw my hands in the air with this because none of it makes sense. And every time I sort of ask, I think probably dumb questions, but I think dumb questions deserve good answers, is that I get like techno babble back. So maybe you guys can help me out. So one of the big drivers here was housing and rent. Rents are just incredible. I can testify to that firsthand. And I think anyone out there listening who's in that situation will as well. How does higher interest rates help that rental situation? doesn't it make, like, call me silly, doesn't it make it worse?
How do you think it makes it worse? By less construction of new houses to solve the problem? Or?
Well, yeah. And every lord of their land will be having higher funding costs, which, you know, shit rolls downhill, if you'll pardon my language. And the whole justification, rationalization of these historically extreme and rapid rises in rents has been, our interest burden's going up, so we have to pass that on to the renter. So that's exactly the narrative, and actually makes a hell of a lot of sense. And now they're saying, inflation's high. And again, Fuel was the other major component here. So again, draw a line for me, an idiot, between the price of fuel and the cost of borrowing. And I'd really appreciate that. I'm dead serious if someone can explain that to me. So we've got these really big factors here. And the response is, let's put up interest rates more. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't necessarily put up interest rates, you know, but I'm just like the rationale, or at least the articulation of it, to me, is left wanting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense. I guess what you're saying with the rents is also that this isn't just so, you could say that the petrol prices, maybe that's a blip, right? So maybe we're rolling through higher petrol prices this quarter, like oil's up a bit. There's some, like, I think, rolling through off of tax benefits disappearing or whatever. But then the rental stuff could be permanent, well, not permanent, but at least enduring for quite a long time, right? Like we've got we just heard today there's 500,000 people, what would you say, arrivals?
A city of Canberra, more than Canberra, arriving every year.
Yeah, it's pretty huge.
And the national vacancy rate, I just read it, is 0.8% nationally. And we're not, and every single construction firm seemingly is going to the wall.
Yeah.
Like, it's not good, man.
You're laughing.
What do you do? Like, you laugh maniacally because it's sort of like, what else is there to do?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the...
Ban Bitcoin.
Don't get him started, please.
That'll fix it. Just ban Bitcoin.
Oh, ban Bitcoin. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, I'm just teasing. Let's blame it on that. All roads lead to Bitcoin. So I'm just saying, provocative thing.
But I guess, okay, the takeaway from what you're saying, though, is rates will keep rising from this. Because, like, previously...
Not what I'm saying.
They'll have to cut rates. Okay.
No, what I'm saying, what the RBA has said, that they will do whatever it takes, right, to tame inflation. And they've just got this giant lever in front of them, like, you know, to the man with the hammer, right? Everything looks like a nail. So they've explicitly said that. Every pundit out there has said it, and the bond market is screaming it. So that doesn't make it a fait accompli, but I think it's not an unreasonable conclusion. And I don't fully understand the connection between the two. It's interesting when you look down the table of items as well that have gone up. You've got things, bread was up 12.6%. You know, you've got, what else you've got here? Like electricity and insurance, things that I just don't feel has any, increasing the cost of debt, right? Like that's the idea here, to reduce demand and therefore reduce prices makes a certain degree of sense if you don't pick at that too deeply. But I don't, even if you want to take it at face value, how am I going to pull back on my insurance costs because my funding has gone up? How am I pulling back on my electricity costs? Do you know what I'm saying? Like these are basics. These are utilities, essentially. I feel as though, I know the retort is, oh, well, it's a crude and blunt instrument, but it's the best we've got. I feel as though it's just like the biggest miss from the media and from all of us, really, anyone who's commenting and on it, is that the government must love this, right? Because the fiscal side of things is completely ignored. And it's the one that, it's the only tool that really has any nuance or capacity to address these things meaningfully.
But yeah, well, fiscal side, I think, is actually pretty interesting, right? Because the deficits that are being run at the moment, aside from COVID, are the biggest ever, basically, right? Like, so the government is just pumping demand or money into the economy effectively through deficit spending. So they're just spending much more. And it's, I think in the US, it was 7% of GDP is government deficit. So that's 7%. That's huge, right? Like it's absolutely massive.
I want to say that I'll interrupt very briefly. Yeah, it is of that magnitude. And something, I think it feels like it's around 20% or maybe higher. I can't remember the exact number, but in terms of not just the deficit, but the government spending itself, if you take out federal fiscal expenditure, I mean, like GDP in the US drops by 20-25%, something incredibly big. So just to add that context, but yes, continue, because I like where you're going.
Well, just the point is, like, I mean, this is the reason we haven't had a recession, right? Like, one of the biggest reasons is that the governments have been spending so much money. Like if you think of a government at neutral would be zero, right? Like, that deficit wouldn't be doing any demand. 7% is basically adding 7% to GDP growth. That's effectively what it's doing each year. Like it's borrowing to do it. It's not a good way to do it, but that's exactly, so like it's huge. Like it's absolutely massive.
Why isn't anyone talking about that? I mean, that is huge, right? And the other thing is, if I want to get a little bit more ideological, is that it leads to massive malinvestment and misallocation of resources, because you have a distortion in the economic machinery here. Government isn't constrained to, in the same ways that private enterprise and individuals are. This isn't a libertarian rant by any stretch. It really, I know how it sounds. It's not. But when you have such a significant part of GDP and spending on things that aren't looked at through a return on investment lens, or a proper capital allocation lens, as I would argue is a pretty good lens to look through most things, not all things, but certainly a lot of things in our modern economy, it invariably, almost definitionally, leads to misallocation and malinvestment.
Yep. It's not good. I guess we've talked about this a fair bit before. I guess the takeaway, though, from what you're saying is rates will keep rising because the RBA is committed to bring inflation down. They only have this one blunt instrument. I think you make some good points that it doesn't actually affect a lot of the parts. I think it affects some parts of the basket, and that's kind of what they would say is like,
sure,
we don't affect everything, we just push these. But they keep doing
it. It affects discretionary items, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, but they, maybe that's all they have, you know, putting their hat on. But then at the same time, the government's just like foot to the accelerator, spending more money, running deficits. And yeah, and then it just could be giving become like the government starts in some places, in states, for instance, giving away more money to cover cost of living rises, right? So you have increases in the deficit to cover the inflation that you're creating. It like is more of a self, you know, perpetuating cycle. But I guess the takeaway is
loop
probably higher
to really be hyperbolic, you know, yeah. It is.
Essentially, basically, higher rates, this and like the recent kind of traction would indicate higher rates for longer and potentially higher government spending. So if we're thinking about like themes, we've kind of touched on government spending a fair bit. I mean, just this week, there was more announcement of, you know, another couple billion for, what is it, critical mineral processing in Australia, mm-hmm. a few more billion for defense, cybersecurity investment. Like a lot of stuff is happening around government involvement in the economy.
Why is government, I'm all for cybersecurity enhancements. Like we are woefully lacking on that front, but it's sort of like, I feel as though we've distanced ourselves too much from pretty core concepts here. It's like the government, this should be there to incentivize certain things that are good nationally, but not to directly be involved, right? It's like, what expertise are they bringing to the table, right? When it comes to cybersecurity, these are the same people who built the COVID app. Let's just bear in mind here for a second, right? So there are high level sound bites that sound good. And hey, look what we're doing. But it's just sort of like, I think too much we look for government to solve issues which require some pretty hard decisions to be made. And in trying to keep us happy, really just make the situation a lot worse, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair potentially. Claude, did you have any thoughts on inflation rates?
I mean, that's a lot. I tend to just sort of skip to, so what should I be doing, I guess. And I think that the problem for investors is that higher rates kind of just generate this sort of like paralysis situation where it's almost as if it's worse when we're in the act of putting rates up, because there's very hard for people to use debt to invest, and just generally it's disincentivized investment or risky investment, because for all you know the money you're getting 4% today, it for on or 4.5% today could be 5% tomorrow. So it's just like you're sort of just incentivized, it slows things down, it's incentivized to just like leave money in the bank for now or to do low risk things. And it's hard to know, you know, recently on the stock market, you know, the main things in small cap land that have been working out have been, I guess, like takeovers and stuff. So my question is, you know, how do you make money in this kind of market investing, like other than shorting, which you can't talk about anyway. You know, one of the ways, certainly for me personally, like some of the good returns recently have come from takeover offers. We had Cirrus Network sort of under offer that I own shares in that got a boost. And then another one I used to own shares in, sold out long ago at higher prices, is Dampstra, which today got an article published about there being a takeover offer above 25 cents. They've put out an announcement today saying they've got some people doing due diligence, and the number that had been, you know, discussed was closer to 30 cents. And that's seen the share price absolutely skyrocket, 135% as of the time of recording on Wednesday, 25th. You know, that's a huge gain. Now, don't get me wrong, I think it was correct to sell this like long before it got down to 20 cents even. It was absolutely, you know, it looks like an absolute shipwreck. But just in time, it seems they just did manage to get out a quarterly that on the 19th that did show finally them sort of crossing over into, or you'd say, if you're going to be harsh, you'd say they're still falling short because you've got to take into account interest costs and lease repayments. But basically, they became free cash flow positive in the most recent quarter. You know, that's something that they should have achieved long ago, and obviously the plan fell apart, but they got there, and then they've received not long after a takeover offer at multiples of the current valuation. So there's definitely some small cap stuff that, in my opinion, has gotten pretty smashed out. But the reason that it has is because, you know, we have had a long period of time of, you know, these increasing rate expectations. And it's not so much just the fact that rates are at a certain amount that kills these stocks. It's the rates going up that you know, people are modeling it with 4% and then it's 5%, and these things take a hit every time. So I reckon, you know, on the one hand, I can't help thinking there probably is some smashed out companies that are sort of pre-profit. But at the same time, nobody, including myself, wants to be too heavily in unprofitable stocks at the moment. I already own like a couple, and, you know, they feel like the riskier ones, so, or a few. So that might be where some extreme opportunities sort of are, where if they do survive this time and then rates at least stabilize and then the growth comes, that could be some opportunity. I mean, the other opportunity is just stuff you think could get taken over. And look, I think bottom picking is hard, but I thought I'd just open it up the floor to discussion of that kind of investing. I mean, it's not something that typically I can't think I've ever sat with you guys and said, you know, oh, I reckon probably the way to make some money is look for stuff that's going to be taken over in, you know, 10 years of investing alongside you. It's not really a game plan that I've ever implemented. But what do you think about that game plan? And is there any sense to it?
Okay. I often think it is initially interesting when a takeover happens, but often on a broader view, disappointing. I feel as though a lot of these offers are very opportunistic. I think I don't know Dempster well enough to comment specifically on that example, but it strikes me that we've had a lot of companies that just got stupid. We've talked about that many times in terms of their prices and where the market's focus was. And then the market focus shifted to viability and sustainability. I think rightfully so. And then things just really got out of control. And so you're seeing these bids come through that look, wow, compared to the volume weighted average price over the last X days looks exciting. It's like, yeah, but still, I mean, in the case of Dempster, right? It was back to prices seen in mid-2022. And this is a stock that was touching $2 a while ago. So it's sort of like these charts look insane until you sort of zoom out and go, hang on, who's getting, and again, I don't want to speak specifically about Dempster. Maybe they're overpaying. I don't know. But it does feel as though in some cases, I'll give you an example. I dialed into the EnviroSuite quarterly briefing this morning, and one of the attendees sort of said, oh, I've heard a rumor of this and that. CEO put cold water all over it. But, you know, it seemed to be, and then another caller sort of said, oh, that's exciting. It's like, no, it's not. It suck. If they made some lowball offer after all of this pain and crap, you tell me I'm going to get forced out of this damn thing. It's something that is like clearly opportunistic. So I'll make that comment. Your comment though, Claude, is one of just like, well, that was then, this is now. I'm allocating capital today. Could I allocate it in a way which makes sense? So that is a different question, and I should answer that one. I think yes, but then I would say I do that anyway. I would say that not intentionally specifically targeting that outcome, but I am definitely trying to buy stuff that I feel is undervalued. And if that can be catalyzed by someone else with a bit more sway, also recognizing that it's undervalued, then hooray, it brings it forward, right? Unless you really see some much higher valuation due to a much longer lens on future cash flows and the rest of it. So it's sort of something that I would happily take opportunistically if I felt as though the price was reasonable relative to my appraisal of value. 100%. I don't think I'd have to think about it, and maybe it'd depend on the situation specifically. I don't think I would make an investment purely because I thought someone else might value it more highly, if that makes sense.
I'd agree with that. That's kind of my approach as well. I think depends on the time. Like, we try to buy quality businesses, and generally quality businesses, they want to keep growing. Like, they don't want to be taken over. There's some exceptions, but I think generally speaking, if a management team are running it well, you don't even want the takeover to begin with. As you said, it can like mean that you don't capture the value. A lot of these acquisitions we're seeing are companies where things have not gone well and the acquisition has come through. And yeah, I guess it's opportunistic. And maybe if you're a long shareholder, you'd say things are going to turn around. But the other view of it is like things aren't going well at that business, right? Like, a lot of these, particularly where you see like the 100% premiums, are because the share price is down, you know, more than 50%, maybe 80% from where it was previously. Yeah, so I guess I think it depends on your style. If you're doing special situations, if you're doing deep value stuff, it can make sense. For me, it's like an easy way to get stuck in a position telling yourself, oh, you know, there could be acquisitions, particularly when people make a thesis where it's like, oh, look at the multiple that other things have been acquired at previously. I just really hate that one because the markets can turn and then you're just kind of stuck there owning something. So for me, it's always a cherry on top, like almost always. And yeah, generally, I don't like hearing management teams talk about it most of the time. It can again be, if it's like the only way, if you what you're building is something that would be really strategic for someone else to buy. So I think a strategic acquisition is very different from like a private equity financial acquisition. If you're building, and you see this more in technology, where it's like you do a lot of work on one really detailed part of the puzzle or part of the solution, you build out some really cool bit of technology, and then it kind of makes sense a bit more to position for an acquisition because that technology can then be leveraged by someone much larger across their whole customer base. But yeah, generally, I just don't like it. I don't like hearing management teams talk about it because it means that they're not thinking about building a long-term business. And I really hate when they don't recognize that trade-off. I've had just a recent meeting where they were saying, I said, oh, what would you do differently if you're planning to like sell the business in 2 years? And like, oh, nothing. And we are like, and it's kind of like, obviously you do. Like you just make different decisions, right? Like if you're trying to present a business to sell in 2 years.
I'm not making any long-term investments. I tell you that right now.
Like it would be suboptimal to do so. So yeah. And you do build the business very differently. I think Rod Drury talked about before he built Xero, he built other businesses to sell and like everything was geared around that, like his attention, the way they built the business. But then Xero, he wanted to build to be, you know, a longer term business, and he did so quite successfully. So yeah, it's an easy one to pass for me.
The other thing I just touch on, in your framing, Claude, you spoke of that play as a consequence of expectations of higher rates. My reaction to that is I would say, if anything, all else being equal, a higher rate environment makes takeovers less likely, just from a cost of capital perspective. It tends to be that there's more M&A activity when money is gushing. So I don't know if I was going to do that strategy in and of itself, I don't know if expectations for higher rates would make me more aggressive on that strategy. Probably the reverse, unless I'm missing something.
I guess it's just, you know, whether you're buying complete, like, I think a lot of these takeover, I guess the takeover angle becomes important because they make a turnaround thesis probably a little bit more attractive. So, you know, the Buffett saying is that turnaround seldom turns. So obviously one wants to be careful with a turnaround thesis in general. But like once upon a time, you could have even said like ProMedicus was a turnaround thesis. So it's like, unless if a company's been around for a while and had some tough times, but it's still got something valuable there, you know, there is a real potential for a turnaround. So I don't want to, you know, discount the idea. Like some good big returns have come from a company that's been cracked out, but it still had a really good asset in there. And so that's something I've been thinking about. And then also, you know, one of the ways you can realize value, as is the case, like we saw IntelliHR a while ago, Dammstra, there was, I think, was it maybe MSL? I can't remember the name now. There've been a couple of little, especially these software companies, like there still seems to be a market for them eventually, because I guess they do have that recurring revenue and someone's like, great, I can fire a few people, it'll be profitable, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I guess in that spirit, you know, something like Bravura to me, which I don't own shares in, is interesting. Well, that one is really an operational turnaround, but with the amount of revenue it has, if it just had, you know, normal software margins, then it could be quite cheap. So if that's possible, then, you know, it may be, that's an interesting one. Another one that I do own that is, I guess, I feel like maybe has some takeover potential would be Alcidion. Now, that's not why I own it. I'd like it to actually just develop and become profitable and stay on the market long term. But that would be a bonus. But, you know, just because it's multiples of revenues are reasonably low now, and there are some pretty large companies in the sort of, you know, healthcare tech software space, I could see one day that potential. I would have, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to guess, like, why is it the Dammstra, which isn't profitable, or these other unprofitable companies like IntelliHR, far from profitable, yet that gets like the takeover and even a bidding war for it. So it's hard to, I don't quite know how one would guess which one of these companies does get an offer and which doesn't as well. So that makes it difficult. I'm certainly not an expert in it, but that's just what we see, you know, driving returns lately is some stuff that's gotten so cheap that then there's a takeover offer. That's probably one of the few ways tech companies have been having, you know, decent moves up recently.
I'll go back to first principles for a moment though. I think if you wanted to identify that, profit could be a bit of a red herring. I probably need to explain myself there, is because that is going to be a heavy, and I think this has been the story of small cap growth technology kind of companies, which is, there's been a lot of really interesting sort of products that have come out of it. Operationally, they haven't been managed well, and they haven't been managed. They've been managed, in fact, rather recklessly, with the expectation of free and easy money to always be there to fund these things. You know, so we play foosball and sit in our beanbags in our WeWork office space and go paintballing every second Tuesday, right? Where instead of putting our nose to the keyboard and bloody building, right? But there are, I would argue, probably not in the majority, but a not insignificant minority of companies on the ASX that have really cool tech, like hyper niche, but still $100 million plus kind of market opportunities. The kind of tech and platforms that no one else has really been building on and is just waiting for someone to come in and offer a genuine solution to customers. Like, hey, you've always done it this way. Why not do it this way? It's much faster and it's easier, and we can just charge you a quarterly subscription and boom, job done. Now, the cash flows and revenues revenues, actually, maybe in this instance, revenues were more telling kind of signal there. Do you get where I'm coming coming from, though. I think that is, to me, and I know I've hung on to companies probably longer than I should have because of that. Because despite mismanagement, despite poor capital allocation, I see a genuinely attractive product and opportunity. And I think that's the way I would approach it, Claude, to answer your question. How do you identify the ones that get the decent premiums? Because someone, and to Matt's point, there are potentially buyers out there, not PE that are looking to be clever with financial engineering, but genuine businesses looking to augment their own product set or enhance their own product set, just looking at that going, wow, we could do a lot with that. And you know what? We don't have to go through 10 years of R&D and development and building up customer base. We just go in and we'll buy it and we'll actually manage the damn thing properly.
Yeah, I think that's what I think the Intelli one, at least, was a bidding war between two strategics. So they could see Intelli like an add-on to what they did, or they're more like traditional payroll companies, and Intelli HR made HR software to kind of wrap around that or make it stickier. So for both of those companies, although it's unprofitable, they could, you know, leverage that into their existing customer base. And I think that's kind of where things can get exciting. Two people who aren't buying just on the financials can lead to a much better outcome. And I think, yeah, that's generally, I would like to hold a business that's doing well, but if it's a strategic bidding war, it can bring forward so many years of growth sometimes that it, yeah, you can't even prefer that to holding it.
My big regret in the last 5 years was Dragontail. I don't know if anyone remembers that tiny, tiny, tiny little company. They were
pizza
doing
photo business. The
pizza photos, right? Like Domino's was incorporating. It was really cool. It was just so dirt cheap and got taken out. And I made like 30, 40%. I can't remember what it was, but I was really gutted by that because I felt as though, again, this is my earlier point, opportunistic short-term thinking that led to that instant.
When was the takeover? Was this like in 2021? Was it?
I want to say it was pre-COVID. Yeah. Pre-COVID? I think it was pre-COVID. And I remember being really disappointed because no one knew about it. And it was just like, seemed to be doing really well. It was also one of these ones, not to go too far off topic, but there's every now and again, oh, is it 2021? Okay. Yeah,
definitely not pre-COVID.
Really? Gosh, it feels like 10 years ago, the way that time is flowing.
Yeah, it's a big distortion with COVID. That's fair. I won't blame you.
All right. Should we race through a bit more small cap news though? You know, being the baby giants and all. We also had Wispier undertaking a capital raising of $3.25 million and a few management changes. So that's at 25 cents per share. And I'm sure we talked about this one in the past as well.
What were the management changes, Claude?
Did you call it Wispier?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Whisper.
Whisper. Well, they spelt it wrong. Why would they do that?
Do you say papier mâché or
no? What it is here? Like, this isn't French, mate. Yeah, no, they spelt it wrong, silly fellas. No wonder the stock's down so far. Anyway,
they got to really drop the I at the end. It needed to be W H I S P R.
Yeah, exactly. Then at least everyone knows you're misspelling
and
it.
And the first I as well.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Oh, vowels are for losers when it comes to tech companies.
Also, do you really need the H? Like, and also, why capitalize Whisper at all? Like, just we're available for hire. Anyhow, yeah, look, the CEO is to transition to executive director. He's going to be driving the strategic growth initiatives. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, the strategic growth has taken the share price all the way down from $4 something to 25 cents placement. So, yeah, more strategy from that. That should be interesting. But other than that, I guess I mostly just wanted to say I called it.
So to pay yourself on the bank.
Yeah, exactly. Because back in October 2022, October last year, damn, I was almost bang on for it by a year. Anyway, so I wrote an article called Why Whisper Will Probably Raise Capital Again, basically, because they said it is confident the business remains sufficiently funded to reach its stated objective of positive EBITDA during the second half of this financial year. And I basically said I thought I was going to raise capital again. Not Look, they did. I will say, even though they are raising capital, they still say that they remain on track to reach cash flow positive during FY 2024. So I don't know what they're real like. I don't know if they're trying to say, oh, you know, we didn't really need to raise capital. We just decided to on a whim, or if they actually were, you know, going to run out, not totally across the details of their forecasts. But either way, it was a massive cash furnace. It was really obviously a cash furnace, and now it's not. So, you know, actually that's maybe you could take it out of the bin. I'm not saying I'm going to take it out of my personal bin, but there could be a case for it.
Well, is it? It's still burning cash, though, I guess. The latest quarterly is it's still burning like 2 million, I think.
Yeah. So look, it's not one that I'm going to rush into, but that was in the news.
Nice.
Another stock that I have no interest in that reported quarterly was Credit Clear, which processes the claims for companies trying to get their bills paid, basically, their debt files. And that could be a segue into what was, I guess, not a small cap news, but a notable talking point this year was an update from Credit Corp, which actually, of course, does lending and buys the debt, which is different from Credit Clear. Just
what
to
was
be
the
distinct.
Update on Credit Clear, Claude?
The Credit Clear update is just, you know, they're still burning cash, basically. Okay. Although they were operating cash flow positive, so that's you know, you potentially positive. They've sort of floated around that level for a while, though. So, yeah, nothing too impressive there, unfortunately, but they also have plenty of cat, or you know, they have 12 million, so you've definitely seen more dire stuff than that. But at the same time, I guess it could also be have its you know, Credit Clear, which is just like this little, I guess, like, you know, service provider to actual debt people who actually own debt. The theory has always been that it would benefit if there was more collecting going on, but yeah, anyway, the lack of it hasn't seen the sort of growth that, you know, I was expecting in the past, and the share price is down, and there's no, you know, real, it does no obvious like inflection point that I can see that it's going to take off or anything. But Credit Corp in the meantime, which is sort of in a similar industry, you know, that's actually been hit hard because it is a debt buyer.
Yeah, shout out to a user on Strawman Mushroom Panda who called this one, Andrew. Do you want to just give a little rundown of what he predicted and what came to pass, I guess, with Credit Corp?
Yeah, aka Michael, without doxing him completely. Picked it like a dirty nose. You know, 3 months, I think it was, ahead of time. This I love this for so many reasons. The main reason I love it is that because I'm so bad at this, which is Mushroom Panda made some really good money over many years on this business and really backed by deep research. And generally, when you get pretty invested into a company, like financially, but also you just do emotionally, like there's a big sunk cost of time and effort in that. And generally speaking, when some red or yellow flags start to emerge, it's easy, or for me at least, to dismiss those kinds of things. And you don't want to give up on all of that effort. But he basically said, not that this will definitely happen and it's going to happen soon, but it's just like, hey, here's a real risk. This is real worrying signs on this. It has broken my thesis. I'm out. And got out, right? And then saved a hell of a lot of money. And it to me underscores the process and value of writing out your investment strategy, being clear with what success looks like and what failure looks like and what a thesis bust looks like. And then actually having the integrity, and like Muggins here, to follow through on that when it happens. And it's just such a great example of excellent process. So yeah, just deserves a shout out.
He'll have to change his name to Blushing Panda after that one, Andrew.
Oh, but it's well deserved, right? Like it's just
good.
And
idea.
I would say that
great call.
I would say that even if that timing didn't happen, right? Because there's obviously, I mean, no one could have predicted the specifics of this. But had it not happened, I still say I salute you, sir, because You've just stuck true to your process, and anyone who can stick true to a process that is half sensible has got such a massive edge on everyone else. And the nature of process over outcome is going to be that sometimes following your process to the letter is going to lead to bad outcome, right? So it again, as we often say, it's probabilistic in nature here. So you can't be too quick to sort of say, you know, X therefore Y in these scenarios. But in terms of saying, hey, here's my process and I'm just sticking to it, that is, for me, the part that especially deserves to be called out and applauded.
Yeah. I was just going to say also, I completely agree on process and I think it just shows the value of Strawman, and obviously Michael himself is a great stocks researcher who generously shares a lot. But also I thought it was interesting in terms of perhaps what it was saying about the macroeconomics. Like if I understand correctly, you know, these guys are actually starting to see that it is getting harder to collect, essentially, and that they've paid too much for debt, essentially, as I understand it. Now, I generally avoid actually these debt businesses, and Credit Corp's been the best of them. But, you know, with Collection House, I think you just saw a complete blow up.
I invested in Collection House personally.
But I mean, so when you pick the wrong one of these businesses, you get a real blow up. Credit Corp, you know, you could probably, basically it doesn't look like the cycle's too good for it now. So even though the stock did drop a bunch, it wouldn't surprise me if there is a bit of a cycle to these kind of businesses. And if there is a cycle like this, I feel like is that's the sharp drop down, you know, $18 to $12. It's like things have changed, you know, things have got bad, like there's reality starting to bite there. So I guess that's interesting for me. And I think it contributes to like an overall feeling of I guess, more bearishness now.
I was going to say, we should probably explain for anyone who's not aware of what Credit Corp, like why this happened, right? Because basically their model is they buy debt very cheap. So I think a lot of people look at, if they think the economy is getting worse, there's going to be more debt collections. So what do you want to buy? Like a debt collector. And I think that was like kind of simple level one thinking. But the challenge is this business model, the way they work, they buy debts for cents on the dollar, you know, pennies on the dollar sometimes. So they'll buy like $100 worth of debt for, you know, maybe $10 or $5 or less, depending on what the debt is, how unlikely people are willing to get it off their books.
And just to be clear here, these are debts from, you know, consumer credit kind of companies or whatever. You've agreed to buy a TV from Harvey Norman on one of their interest-free plans or something. You just haven't done it. Now, rather than Harvey Norman run around and collect it, they bundle that up and then they sell it to someone else. And they're just happy to get a little bit of money back and get, you know, write it off. And if you can collect obviously more than what you paid for it, then you get a positive ROI. And that's the game.
That's exactly right. And so, yeah, that's where these things can get into trouble. A, they're like very financial, so it's very easy for them to choose how much their profits are by kind of reporting or I guess changing their assumptions about how much they're going to collect. Like it's possible to book profits by saying we expect to collect more on this book, and so therefore we're writing up the value or whatever. And so what happened in this case was Michael had been tracking it, seeing that they kind of had this expanding book value where they hadn't been collecting as much effectively, like the debt ledgers had been, the balance had been increasing effectively. They hadn't been collecting as much as you would imply they expected to. And it was building up and building up. And basically that would lead to them having to write it down. And that's exactly what happened. So now they've written it down. Therefore, profits are going to be lower. Therefore, the outlook for the business is worse. And so it kind of fell like 30% on the morning of that news after falling down a bit before. But I just think to frame it, like that's the surprising thing. Like you think you're buying a debt collector that's going to do well in tough markets, and it struggles at least that part of the cycle.
Yeah. And just got to point out too that this isn't a tiny little nano cap that no one follows. Credit Corp's a big company. There's a lot of high paid analysts that follow this. And they all missed it. And it's your point, Matt. It was right there. No, I didn't see it either. But you know, this is, I think, too often as a private investor, you can sort of look at these things and go, well, why isn't anyone else saying this? It must be me who's wrong on that. And Michael, I just obviously had such a deep understanding of, I mean, this is why it pays to understand the business model and the mechanics and how it actually functions. And it can get pretty complex here to such an extent that all the experts missed it as well. So there is good advantage to be had in having a little bit of informational edge over a lot of people. Because, I mean, it's not that the market should or we should ever expect it to be 100% right 100% of the time. But the very nature of the quantum of that move suggests just how wrong the market
was. Yeah, 100%.
All right, fellas, thanks for that detour through Credit Corp. I'm very instructive and always like an interesting company for a number of reasons. Just to round out the small cap news for this week, I thought I'd just touch on Setter really quickly. We have got an article on their Q1 FY2024 update on the website if anybody wants more details. But, you know, the basic, I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on this, the basic takeaway was that it's still a sort of revenue and adjusted EBITDA kind of story. Not quite sure what the actual profit will be after share-based payments, etc. However, you know, I guess the longer-term question is how good is a competitive advantage for Setter? You know, ultimately, in a way, it's like you're trying to shift inventory and you're competing with various other websites that do similar things. And also, you know, the companies themselves who have their own to market, given that Setter is sort of a separate way, you know, supposedly at least partly for not the prime stock. So yeah, that it was rapid growth, but at the same time, you know, still remain cautious of that, not saying I love it just because it's growing. And of course, you know, this the founder has been selling down a few times over time, so that's never a positive anyway. And that's it for me this week from the small cap news.
Nice one, man.
Cool.
Any thoughts on Setter, you guys? Any wanted to chuck in any small cap news? What else is any reporting caught your eye?
I've been across satire, so I can't speak on that. I said to Matt off air, I'm reluctant to mention it because I'm such a one trick pony with the stocks they talk about. But Ava Risk Group, they had their
quarterly.
It was very decent to my mind. They've basically said that they should get a decent result in the first half, and the second half is still expected to remain very strong. It will have to be pretty strong to come into some of the ambitions that they've laid out there. But it seems doable, and it's just the market. So meh, so I just won't move. So it's either something's going to happen one way or the other with this thing, I feel, and I lean towards the optimistic take on that kind of thing.
Or nothing.
And on what? Yeah. There's...
Do you mean like a takeover? Is that what you mean? Or it doesn't
matter? No, I feel as though the market is... Mal, the CEO's come out and basically said, this is what we're doing. We feel as though we can achieve these goals. They've laid it out very specifically over a three-year period with very ambitious goals, like really high goals. Gosh, it'd be nice if you got there, but frankly, even if you get halfway there, it seems like it's a decent opportunity. And it's another one of those ones where I think I've got to be careful here. I think too myopic of view on a lot of the financials in particular, just set reporting periods are going to lead you astray here. There was the big divestment of the services business. That was one thing. They've had a distribution agreement with dormakaba and how they're looking to broaden into other markets through a partnership arrangement, which was awaiting some certification, which actually came through in the recent quarter. And then their partner had to stock up on all of that kind of stuff. And there's things that sort of dominoes that are being lined up, it feels to me. And which require a lot of investment. It's just they haven't yet shown their worth. And maybe they don't. Maybe they don't show their worth. But I feel as though there is some potential to it. And the market, whether the market might prove to be right here, but the market seems to be, I'm just inferring from the share price action here, saying, we don't think you're going to do it. And if they're right, well, then fair enough. But if they're wrong, then I think there'll be a re-rate, yeah, which is the most obvious. Say that out loud. It's like, yeah, that's pretty much how markets work, Andrew.
Very good. All right, should we wrap it there?
Yeah, let's wrap it.
All right, cool. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Hit us up on Twitter at Baby Giants Pod. A couple of questions came through this week, which we'll get to next week, I think. But until next time, thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, guys.